The lessons learned from Chevrolet's small block program. Did Ford go far enough with the new Mustang? And what can Cadillac do?
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 258 for September 19th. The secrets of Chevy's legendary small block V8. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Want to thank all of you out there for tuning in again for another episode of Autoline After Hours. We're doing it a little bit different this week. Gary Vasilash is not with me this week. He's out traveling someplace. I just got back in. In fact, we were not even able to change the studio set to be the regular Autoline After Hours one, but it doesn't matter because we got some pretty good things to get into here. And I've got to start out by introducing Drew Winter from Ward's Auto World, and great having you back here
on
After Hours.
John.
And Todd Lassa from Automobile Magazine. Todd, great having you too.
John, thanks for having me on again. Always good to be here.
And then our guest right now is Dave Cole from AutoHarvest.org. And Dave, great having you here.
Oh, it's terrific to be with you, John.
And just so everybody knows, Dave is the son of Ed Cole, former president of General Motors, also led Chevrolet Engineering. And in fact, that's one reason why, Dave, I really wanted to have you on this show. You wrote an article that I found fascinating about the development of the small block V8 at GM, that your dad led that on, and how it all came together.
Many, many years ago. It was an interesting
thing.
This
is what, about 1954?
53, 54 for introduction, and the fall of 54 is a 55 model year product. It was an all-new Chevrolet. The only thing that wasn't new that year was the two-speed Power Glide transmission. Everything else was new, including the small block V8. And it was interesting because I was a kid then, and so I saw this stuff going on. And a friend asked me for the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. They have a sort of a historical session planned, do something on the small block. And, of course, was well aware of it. I became a professor of engineering. I taught engines and so on. And it was fun to think of it as a kid and then to think of it as an adult. And then one of my friends who had been a part of that team, he's died a few years ago, Kai Hansen, I had a chance to spend a lot of time with him talking about that whole process of everybody coming together to do the 55 and of course, the small block. It was also interesting, some of you may have been there, participated in they had a celebration at the special engine group of GM out in Novi for the 100 millionth small block.
And 100 million has a nice ring to
it, doesn't
it?
It's a big number.
Big round number, yeah.
And it's hard to believe. Obviously, the engine is not the same. I mean, it's aluminum and dramatically different, but the basic architecture is the same. And that was one of the things that was really kind of struck me, is that the way they approached it. When I wrote this paper, I really divided it into two parts. One part was the team that came together to do this, and the other was the engine. And my dad had been chief engineer at Cadillac in the late 40s. He had worked on tanks during World War II and became chief engineer, and they did a overhead valve Cadillac engine that was very much state-of-the-art. He had a little interlude with a tank plant in Cleveland during the Korean War. It was a bean warehouse that they converted to a plant to make tanks. And then Chevrolet said, come and visit us. Actually, they asked him to be works manager in charge of manufacturing. He said, no, I'm not interested in that. They said, well, how about chief engineer? Okay, I'll do that. And one of the things that was part of the deal is that we want you to develop or lead the development of a small Cadillac engine for Chevrolet. And he said, no, I wouldn't do that. And at that time, a lot of people are not aware of this, every General Motors division had its own engine operation, Cadillac, Buick, Olds.
They were standalone car companies.
They were standalone car companies. And, of course, later on with threats of antitrust action, that was changed. That was one of the things that occurred that people still don't know a lot about, but it was an interesting episode in itself. But he went across the corporation, every division, engineering staff, GM research. For example, the stamped rocker arm came out of Pontiac. Another division had this inverted casting technology. And this was very counter to the traditional GM culture that was everybody is a simple standalone unit and you really competed with the other people in the company. And he said, no, if we're going to do really something unique, let's take the best ideas that we have and put them together.
So did he just take ideas from around the corporation?
No, people.
Or did he take people,
oh,
too?
People. People.
And that must have caused some consternation.
Well, I don't know all of the details of that, but it was quite an earthquake in the corporation when they did this. Just to jump ahead a little bit, my dad went there in 53. They put this new engine, the small block V8, they also had the old Blue Flame 6, and the full car, body, chassis, powertrain, interiors. It went from when they started to in the dealership in 23 months.
Which would be almost an impossibility today, to move that quickly.
Guess what? It was an impossibility then, too.
That was the thing that stuck out when I saw that. When you said that, I thought, my God, you know, in those days, this was, of course, they had no computer-aided design,
That's
no
right.
3D printing, none of this fancy stuff. How did they? Obviously, it was fast even then. But
well,
I mean,
they didn't have lots of regs. There weren't the safety regulations or the emission regs or anything like that. So there were pluses and minuses. But what it really convinced me of when I was a kid watching it is that, man, this is a team sport.
But Dave, don't you think too? Here are guys that, like you said, your dad worked on a tank plant in World War II. That whole mindset of the war was get it done now.
Oh.
You know, you better get that new fighter or tank or ship or whatever it is into the war right now because the war will be over if you're going to take the normal procurement.
This was true across the whole auto industry. There was a sense of urgency associated with the war ever, whether it was Ford building B-24s or Jeeps, tanks, it doesn't make any difference. There was a focus that was unbelievable. And that was carried over. And that's one of the things that, you know, I wonder if that's there today. Things
it's not
are obviously a lot more complicated.
Well, it's similar to what happened with the war effort when the Defense Department put out a request for a Jeep proposals. And they had Ford and Willys and Bantam propose different designs. And they did that so quickly. So, yes, I think you're right, John. There's a huge connection between the kind of war efforts that got those products out quickly and the GM effort. But how much did the fact that your father and his team decided to pick certain parts that were already out there, how much did that play into getting that done in 20
Well, I think
months?
One of the advantages that he had as a chief engineer on the Cadillac program is that he had seen all of this happening. And he was a fundamentally sound engineer. And one of the things that he saw in contrast at Cadillac is that Chevrolet had to be inexpensive and simple. So they really drove to simplicity. For example, in one of the, they cut the number of cores in half.
Sand cores for
sand
casting
cores.
The block.
And you put these sand cores together, you cast the block. They did it in. Because of the dimensional variation you expect on every core, if you cut those number of cores in half, all of a sudden now you're able to cast a thin wall block, cylinder wall, that you couldn't do with all those other cores. There was an inverted technique that they used for the head. And one of the things that it led to is some variation in the properties of the material at the bottom of the casting that were superior for the top. And what also was interesting from the team perspective is that they never stopped. They were in the basement at night and the garage and driveway on weekends. We lived on the north west side of Detroit. And I remember in particular Kai Hansen, who was a Danish immigrant, had come over and was part of it. He always brought Danish pastries. That's where I learned to love sweets, and I still do. But it was also interesting to talk to Kai afterwards and said, well, just how do you did it? As a kid, you see it. You don't know how to ask the questions. And one of the things that Kai said is that it really was a team effort. He said one of the challenges was we had some very independent thinkers that didn't like one another very much, and that was probably my dad's greatest challenge, is to get people into a team. And one of the things he said that they did is that they would agree that's done, that decision was made, and they moved on. And in terms of the small block, they really only had one defect, and that was a little higher oil consumption early that went away after a few thousand miles, and they changed that quickly. But it was remarkably successful in terms of performance, and it was, 40 pounds lighter than the Blue Flame 6, which had six fewer cylinders. But it was an amazing thing to...
Two fewer cylinders,
that's right. Yeah. It was amazing to kind of look back at that period through the eyes of what I know now, although I have to tell you I've forgotten a lot about what I used to teach in internal combustion engines. But it emphasizes the whole issue of what we are seeing in Detroit today. The king is dead. It's a coach. The king says, you do this, you have the responsibility for it, but you don't really provide the responsibility to do it. And what you see in people like Alan Mulally, I would say Mark Royce, Mary Barra, they are coaches. They recognize that the only way you can be successful in this business is with a team. And that's what really Chevrolet had at that time, is they had a team that knew what they wanted to do and that ultimate objective. My dad was really the coach of the team, but the expertise that was drawn from all over General Motors was really brought together in kind of a systems approach, and it worked. And it's one of those things that if you, I think, had looked at it and said, well, you can't do that. And this was what the opinion was of a lot of people at that time. Well, you're never going to pull that one off. Oh, you're going to have those in dealerships in less than 2 years. And they were there. And that, of course, was interesting because Ford was kind of the, with their V8 and a little bit more of an upscale feel in the car. And so Ford was the target. And if you're going to take on that target, you had to have a really good power plant. And I think that's what that small block became.
That's a great point. I mean, you mentioned that the 55 Chevy was all new except for the transmission.
Right.
And that car also elevated Chevrolet in the GM lineup as being a car that offered more than you paid for it, basically. It was a little bit nicer. It had kind of a semi-premium look in the day. And so could you talk a little bit about how far along was the design for the 55 Chevy when that engine, when they decided to do the V8?
Yeah, I think the basic shape and everything out of design staff was probably pretty much intact. But and this is with body, the chassis. I mean, there are a lot of things that were kind of changed when he came on the scene. And if you knew my dad, he had his eyes on what he wanted to do. And it was not as easy for him to say, well, I'll just carry through what you guys had started. And that was the case with the engine. And he really knew cars. I mean, he was a GMI
Wait,
almost
Wait, are you saying
grad.
They had already started on an engine?
No. Well, they had been working on engines, but not this engine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the expectation was that let's take the Cadillac engine and let's turn it into a Chevrolet engine.
And he said, forget that.
He said, hey, that's a crazy idea. We learned too much that we wouldn't do if we did it a second time.
Yeah.
And this is often the case. And part of that, I think, when he was at Cadillac, he really knew his way around the company. Engineering staff, GM
Research. I was going to ask you that. How did he know that there were these other technologies and the people in different divisions in the company?
He talked to them. He went around. He saw them. Obviously, they were tearing down everybody else's engine, and he saw, man, that's really cool, that stamped rocker arm. And, oh, man, that's a guy at Pontiac. And if you looked at that, look at the old shaft and the rocker arms, and here's this simple stamping on a, and I remember, wow, that's really amazing. And we had things that happened. We had a 50, he had a 53 black Chevrolet, the only one, and with that small block in it. And one of the fun things I remember, we were in Grand Rapids where relatives live. We were going to go up fishing near the Baldwin area in mid-Michigan. And there's a, this was before freeways, and there's a stretch of about 8 or 10 miles of perfectly straight highway. Well, anyway, we were on that, and he was always a very fast driver, scared the liver out of my mom quite often, and my sister, never me. I like fast. But we stopped for breakfast at a restaurant in Baldwin, Michigan. We were going to fish on the Pier Marquette or the Little Manistee River. I can't remember which. But we pulled in there. We were ordering breakfast, and a police car pulled up outside. And a policeman walked in. Who's got that black Chevy? And I was, oh, that's mine. I've been trying to catch you for 30 miles. What in the world do you have in that car? This was before speed limits, and he wasn't really breaking any laws. So the whole restaurant evacuated. They went out. The hood came up, and they were all looking at, man, this isn't a Chevrolet. And they used to do this in gas stations because, remember, oh, I'm going to check your oil, and flipped up the hood. The gas station jockey would come out. Where's the dipstick? And pretty soon he'd be out there, and he would just stand back there and watch these people and smile as they kind of, oh, this is really something pretty unique. And as it turns out, it really was.
Dave, you mentioned, go ahead, Drew.
I was going to ask, what are the characteristics that have made it, have given it such great longevity, though? I mean, it's a basic, a lot has, certainly an awful lot has changed on it, but you still got the basic,
precision.
What, 90-degree architecture
yep,
and everything.
90-degree, that's perfect inherent balance, but precision.
And like isn't bore centers still the same?
Pretty much. It's very basic architecture, but things like cutting the number of cores in half and going to thinner wall castings, predictably thinner wall, has a dramatic impact. And then you start having a weight compounding kind of thing in terms of the basic engine structure. The head, for example, and the intake manifold, rather than have this steel plate over the over the tappets and the valve operation, that was it. And in the then in the head, they had all of these different things. You know, fasten the carburetor there. You had the oil intake. You had all of these functions that were really put into the same component. And that's really why when they took a systems approach, they ended up with a very structurally sound engine. It was very quiet, and it was light. I mean, it was dramatically lighter than the competitive engines. And, of course, the durability and everything turned out to be really well. But as I look back on it, it would be a perfect example of what I say is good systems engineering, is that you just don't deal with one thing. Ooh, I did that here. This means I can do something over here. And the thinking of the big picture, like with connected vehicles, autonomous vehicles, one of the biggest potential factors there is we can reduce accidents dramatically. Guess what? If you reduce highway accidents, you can go into emergency rooms, which have their trauma care is primarily for auto accidents. So you can get these compounding effects, and they started out with that idea. And I think considering that all of the ones that were engine guys had worked on engines, and they knew what they could do better, and they knew what the other guy was doing, and it was really the assembly of that kind of a team approach that that was important.
So was the small block team able to, did they move on to do other great things, or did they break up and lead other teams and things like that?
I'm not exactly sure. Some of them, Harry Barr was a part of that. He became chief engineer of Chevrolet, and there are a number of people that were a part of that effort that moved to other places because it was a very successful effort, and the company felt that it had learned something. And I can tell you something I saw later, and some of you are probably well aware of. My dad was sometimes a difficult guy to manage in a lot of ways. For example, occasionally when he would be giving a speech and they'd have this nice written speech and he'd flip it closed and talk off the cuff, and you knew somebody on the 14th floor was, oh, man, what are we going to hear now? And But he was driven by technology and driven by the market that he wanted to be associated with something that was special. And this was really, and it was a follow-on great opportunity considering what they had been doing at Cadillac with tanks and then the post-war Cadillac and the Cadillac V8.
You mentioned that one of his greatest challenge was holding this team together, some people who didn't like each other. Did you learn anything? I mean, did you get any insights as to how he might have done that?
Well, I got that from Kai, and he said it's sort of a something sweet and a stick kind of together. And I think you like to have people work this way, but they also know that there are consequences if they don't. And frankly, my dad was not uncomfortable with providing some serious consequences. I felt that numerous times.
Well, look, why don't we wrap up this part of the conversation? We'll take a quick break now. We'll come back in another minute or so and get to some of the questions that have been coming in. If you don't have your question in yet, get it in now, because we'll be getting to it right after this break from our great friends, the car company that has never made a car. You'll know what that's about in a moment.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
We've got a number of questions that have come in here, Dave, so we ought to get to them. Rum and Coke wants to know, did the term small block exist before the introduction of the big block? And what is the derivation or how did that term come about?
I'm not sure. Obviously, they have a big block, and if you have a big block, that means you've got a small block somewhere, too. Because it's just a block otherwise. But as they went into, the 427 and the big block engines, I never really heard so much about the small block as a small block at the time.
You just heard V8.
It was a V8.
Yeah.
It really grew later. You know, it was kind of like the University of Michigan football stadium. It used to be the University of Michigan football stadium. Now it's the big house.
Yeah.
It happens.
That sounds familiar. It seems to me that I didn't hear small block so much in the 60s or 70s,
right.
But that it came along later. I want to let you get back to the questions, but a question about the Pontiac V8, because 1955 was the first year of the first Pontiac V8, and that must have started earlier in the process.
I think it did, but some of the Pontiac guys came over to Chevy.
Ah, okay.
And of course, because of the volume at Chevy and because of the cost issues of of the lowest price product in the marketplace, I think they tended to be able to do some things that the other guys couldn't have done.
Mm-hmm. Marco Morello says, which do you prefer, Ford's Coyote V8 or GM's small block V8? Marco, I think you're asking the wrong guy here. I know what Dave's going to say.
Well, what I would say is that the engines today are fabulous, and the execution is tremendous. You go back 10, 20 years, and I've been around this business a long time, there were differences. Yeah, we saw quality differences, 8 defects for some car, 2 defects for another car. Now you look at the modern ones, 0.9, 1.2. The powertrains, the execution on products for the global players is really astoundingly good. Some of the Chinese not aligned with major manufacturers, they're still kind of soft and weak, and we see that elsewhere. But the major manufacturers are selling the products here are all really good. I mean, this is a wild competitive environment, and both those engines are fabulous.
Yeah. Ben, I'm unclear. Do we have a phone call coming in?
Yes, we do.
Okay, let's bring it in.
Yes, Jim Campbell calling from Calgary, Canada. Can I get your guest to comment a little bit more on the rivalry between Pontiac engines and the Chevrolet engines? And maybe even the Oldsmobiles and the Buicks. I think they all got kind of into some good competition. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Yeah, the fact is, and there's no question about this, the internal competition between the divisions of GM was extraordinary. And that, I think, was one of the things that drove GM to such a successful period, 40s and 50s. That's right, because they learned from one another, but they competed with one another. And it's, of course, that's all disappeared now as you have corporate engines that are spread all over. And part of the reason for that is economics. Part of the reason for that is it's a lot harder to break up a company if they don't have their separate engine operations. And I don't know if most people may not be aware that the Justice Department had a GM section for many years. And I can remember as a kid hearing stories about that. And that's where CPC and all of these things came from, is to try to make GM much more difficult to break up. At one point, for example, with the 50s and so on, they could have pulled Chevrolet out very easily. Mm-hmm. And that
and it still would have been the biggest car company in the world.
It would have been a big car company. The internal competition was something, I don't know whether people really did this on purpose. I think it just happened. They're all at the GM proving grounds. They're all running the cars. They're all driving each other's cars. And that competition is what really drives innovation. And that was a really, really good thing. And sometimes you get an unintended consequence of this. I think when you go back to Alfred Sloan and how he structured things, I'm not sure if he really thought about that.
Dr. Botox has got a great question that ties in right with this. He said, did the individual divisions own the intellectual property, or is the IP controlled by corporate GM?
No, this was really corporate IP. I mean, even then, they may have thought, well, this is ours, but if somebody thought, well, I could use that, it was going to move.
And you remember there was a little bit of a fiasco in 1977-ish when the new downsized Olds Delta 88 came out with the Rocket 88 nameplate on the air cleaner. But it had a small block V8 from Chevrolet.
Yeah.
And it was considered kind of a downgrade because you were paying Oldsmobile money and getting a Chevrolet engine.
Right.
The irony, of course, is that the Chevy engine was probably better than the Olds engine of the time.
It's amazing how, our thought process has changed. Because today we think, so what? You got a V8. What's the big deal? But I still remember, was it Pete Estes, I think, at the time said, he didn't realize how much this one owner, because I think the guy even sued General Motors, remember right.
Yeah, there were
but
lawsuits.
He said it never hit him that this guy had wanted a Rocket V8 his whole life, and he had finally achieved a level of income where he could afford that Rocket V8 and was crushed when he learned it was a Chevrolet.
Oh, I can understand that. I mean, people had really narrow likes and dislikes. I mean, I'm a Cadillac guy, I'm a Lincoln guy, I'm a Ford guy, and it's still there to some extent, but it's been muted pretty dramatically. But, one of the things as I look back on that era is what do we learn? And how can we learn from what's happened in the past? And one of our concerns today is the loss of talent. We don't have the talent that we need. We're not getting kids thinking about auto as or manufacturing in general as a career. But one of the things that is really, really critical is that teams are required to play these complex games. That is, nobody is smart enough as an individual. And we have had individuals that were kings. I'm not going to name names, but you can think of them. And it really didn't work out because you can't deal with something as complex and as sophisticated as a car, which is, this is the most complex industry in the world. And kings are dead. The other kind of interesting thing, and I don't know if I should say this publicly, we're moving from what I would say is historically more of a male-based approach to leadership to more of a female-based approach, where it's collaboration, relationships, connectivity. And it's also a struggle for a lot of us that are engineers. I look at what I was initially as an engineer. The joke is, and finance people, we tend to be very quantitative. Show us a number, you can make a decision. Most engineers are introverted. When I was teaching engineering, and I would say, well, you're going to have to make a presentation at the end of the semester on your design project, they'd come up to me and say, I don't know enough words in the English language put together to talk for 5 minutes. Invariably, after they spent a semester working on the design project, you had to shut them off because they had so much to say about the work that they did. But we have to learn from the past. And the team's work, leadership is critical. And one of the key aspects of leadership is that you got to be comfortable with yourself. If you're trying to lead and prove yourself as being a man every day, it's not going to work.
You know, I think you just said the key thing there. We can learn from the past.
Yeah.
And when we can take great examples like how the small block Chevy V8 came to be developed and all the different issues that you talked about, there's a lot of learning that can be applied to today.
Yes, yeah. I've discovered that repeatedly. I've continued to learn from my wife, my sons, my grandchildren, and I think they learn from me every once in a while anyway.
Dr. David Cole, thanks so much for coming in and sharing that story.
It's my pleasure, John. It was great to be here with you and
good deal.
Others. Yeah.
And now we're going to take a quick break and look at some of the other coverage that maybe you haven't seen on Autoline.tv.
Have you seen what's been happening on our other shows lately? Here's a little coverage from Autoline Daily this week. On Monday, we looked at the sad auto sales in Russia while India's boom. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, John's Seat Time Review looks at the new Lincoln Navigator, which he thinks is a little off course. And on Wednesday, you heard about the yellow light Wall Street issued on Tesla. For more details on these stories, check out our website or YouTube channel. And don't forget our latest episode on Autoline this week, spotlighting the best ways to buy a car. All that and more on Autoline.tv.
Real interesting. I never knew the story behind the development of that engine. I knew the fast development time.
Yeah.
In fact, there's another great example. When the Chevy 2 was done, I want to say this was 1962, they did a two-door, a four-door convertible and station wagon that went into five different plants. And that was done, I want to say, in 18 months. Now, I don't think it was as clean sheet as the 55 was, but still, it's staggeringly fast.
What I've heard is that Chevy was kind of doubling up on its, or not doubling up, but covering its bet on the Corvair, and actually started looking at doing that car maybe a little bit earlier than everybody knows.
Oh, really? Okay.
But 18 months is at least the official amount of time. That was certainly a rush job. Let's do what Ford did and take a full-size car and cut it down to compact size because the Corvair might just be too radical.
Yeah. In defense of today's engineers, though, I'd just like to point out, you know, back in those days, were in like 55, they had like, you know, two cars and a truck to do for
right.
the whole...
Exactly right.
The whole company.
Right.
And the other thing is, you know, no crash, no, you know, I mean,
no emissions,
none of this other stuff that takes a long time.
No question about it. Hey, speaking of that, time to develop a new car and everything, I just got back from driving the new Mustang, and my own impression is Ford's got a big hit on its hands. I was really impressed by this car. The pictures, I don't think, do it justice. To me, the car looks way better out on the street than anything that I've seen before, and it drives beautifully. This is the best Mustang, in my opinion, that's ever been made yet. I don't know what your guys' reaction to it has been.
Our West Coast editor, Michael Jordan, liked it a lot. He had, you know, a few nits to pick, but he thought it was a big improvement over the previous cars, too. Much to your point, much more refined, much easier to drive, just a good all-around car with the performance. He drove both the V8 with a manual and an EcoBoost 4 with the automatic.
Right. And, yeah, that 2.3-liter EcoBoost was particularly impressive. Really nice driving. I thought at lower RPM levels, though, it did sound like a 4. Once you get your foot into it, especially once you get over 4,000 RPM, wow, it does not sound like a 4-cylinder engine, and it performs really well.
But you're paying a premium for it,
you
right?
are, yeah.
So what's the reaction going to be?
Well, I want to see what the pricing is. I did not see a breakout for what they're going to charge for these engines. We did not get to drive the base V6 mm-hmm. either. So the EcoBoost 4 was terrific, but yeah, what are they going to charge for it? The V8, the 5-liter V8, drives brilliantly well, but I'll bet you it's like a $5,000 option.
Well, Michael's car, the V8 engine story went up first. The V8 car is online at automobilemag.com, and I want to say that the bottom line was something like $46,000.
Right.
Now, this is all loaded.
Loaded up, right.
A GT premium, which means the V8 with the premium package right. and all the optional safety items like cross-traffic alert and forward collision alert and automatic cruise control and all those other things. And, you know, so that's a fairly pricey car. That said, the base price with the 6, which, by the way, lost a few horsepower to make room for that EcoBoost. Mm-hmm. So the EcoBoost has 5 or 10 horsepower more than the V6, which used to have 305 and is now down to 300. You know, that starts in the, what, $24,000,
$25,000
price range,
yeah.
I think, for the V6. And then
right.
EcoBoost, I think, well, typically they've had a 995 premium over the base engine on other EcoBoost models, but that has been mostly for the V6 EcoBoost or a V8 or even a standard V6.
Yeah, I drove the EcoBoost with the automatic transmission, pretty well loaded up car. It was, if I remember right, around $32,000 is what they told us. But, yeah, I, to your point, Drew, I think the key is going to be what are they going to charge for these engines?
Well, I guess, and what's the audience for the car, too? Did they talk about, I mean, how much is repeat Mustang buyers and how much is new buyers? I mean, obviously it's going to be sold in Europe, so there's going to be...
Well, all around the world. You know, okay. They're doing right-hand steer versions of this from the factory. So
they're looking for new buyers.
Oh, and, there's no question about it.
Well, they're looking for new buyers in the way that the Chevy Camaro, when it returned for the 2010 model year, did, because it hadn't had buyers for a decade, and you know, the old buyers had that kind of mullet hair image, and the Camaro kind of appealed to people who had gone through three or four Camrys or that sort of car, and now wanted something a little sexier and didn't need a back door necessarily. The Camaro has outsold the Mustang most months since then. So the interesting thing to watch will be not just the first year new Mustang, 2015. I will bet you anything that it's going to beat the Camaro for at least that first year. And then the next year we'll see a 2016 Camaro. And so which car will reign supreme in that sales race?
But listen to what we're talking about. You know, here it's like, you know, Mustang sales are up, Camaro sales are up. Dodge just came out with a, you know, the Hellcat Challenger.
Yeah.
Sales of the Corvette are through the roof, up 300% in the last month. You know, we weren't supposed to be talking about this. We weren't supposed to be talking about this muscle car revival, not in 2014. Remember, muscle all died in the 70s. Yeah. This was never going to come back again.
Well, and people are buying pickup trucks again, and they're spending a lot of money on pickup trucks. That is the suburban cowboys who don't necessarily need them for
big
work.
Big SUVs,
Big SUVs. And you know, gas prices now have settled somewhere in the $3.50 per gallon range, and apparently that's not too much for people buying these cars.
While there's political unrest in the Middle East, I mean, this is all territory.
But we're producing a lot of our own oil lately, and that makes a big difference, too.
I think that these muscle cars, though, have gotten to be so good that they're opening up the market to others who would not have
been.
Well, they talk about demographics because, of course, the old adage is, well, it's just a bunch of old baby boomers buying them, you know. And
I don't think that's the case, though.
You know, the Mustang for a long, long time, I mean, you know, several since the 90s at least, maybe earlier, has also been a car where they've sold lots of V6 convertibles, not only to rental fleets, but also to people who, again, just wanted something kind of nice and sporty, even if those drivers didn't drive it like it was a sports car. Kind of like the original Mustang, like the 65. A lot of those were sold with six-cylinder engines, with convertibles or coupes with automatics for, you know, $2,700, $2,800. And so I think they've always had that kind of base, as well as the muscle car base that we know of, the people who are our readers and follow, you know, what we write about. But you know, I don't think that mix is changing all that much, and it's always going to be an alternative for someone who has grown tired of minivans or midsize sedans, or has room to have one of each. You know, a family that can have two cars. And this is.
But I guess what I'm saying is, I think the base car is going to appeal to a wider band of buyers
than previous base cars.
Than previous base cars. And yeah, so I think you're right. It's going to be boomers primarily going for the GT with the 5-liter engine. But I think once you get down into the base V6, and this is true of all these cars, whether you're talking the Camaro or the Challenger too, they get pretty decent fuel economy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for what they are, they get pretty decent fuel economy. The Camaro and the Mustang are really two-seaters. I mean, they're in much room. The Challenger offers a pretty decent back seat. I think if the Mustang and the Camaro were a bit more passenger-friendly, that they could increase sales even more.
Now, I have now my problem with the car, I told you I have a problem with the car, and I have not driven it yet. I have to preface it with that, and it's not really a problem with the Mustang directly so much as the segment has not changed enough, I think, in the last few years. I think if we had a new Camaro or a new Challenger somewhere along the way that was downsized to more of, say, a BMW 4 Series size, which is not that much smaller than the Mustang, but it's a little bit trimmer, feels smaller, drives smaller than at least the current Mustang. Again, I haven't driven this one. I think there, this could be a much more radical redesign. I think it's an evolution, not a revolution.
I agree.
Totally agree.
I'd like to see a little smaller.
Agree.
I'd like to see something a little smaller.
They played it a little bit conservative in that regard.
IRS, yes, but other than that.
Yeah. Hey, let's come back and talk more cars, more industry stuff after we take this quick break from our good friends at Hyundai.
Nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
So this industry never sleeps. You know, we're all watching what's happening at Cadillac these days. They looked like a few years ago they were really off to the races, and then things have really come apart for them, at least from a sales standpoint. Now they've gone off and hired Johan Denison. What are you guys expecting to happen there?
They have it's a very competitive market. The luxury market is it's booming since the Great Recession. More rich people are buying new cars than middle class people are. And Cadillac has come a long, long way since then, just with its new product, the product that was kind of in the pipeline, you know, before General Motors went into bankruptcy. And now I think it's a little bit of a perception catching up with reality. I think they still have a little bit of work to do on, say, interior fit and finish versus the German cars. But in terms of the dynamics, say, of the new CTS or the Cadillac ATS, it's fabulous. I think, you know, it's actually a little bit of like what Chevrolet has done with the Impala. Everybody likes this new Impala way more than the previous one, which was long in the tooth and had been on the market way too long. And the problem with the old Impala was that, you know, it had been on the market so long that dealers could sell it at such a discount that it would compete with their own Malibu. Now they've got an Impala where they shouldn't be selling as many Impalas as they were selling before. Well, it's kind of the same with Cadillac. If Denison holds the price on those, and this is a guy who spent most of his career at Audi and did a great job with them, and Audi is still, even though every month it's got greater sales numbers than the previous month or the year earlier, it's still way smaller than BMW and Mercedes or Lexus for that
matter. In the U.S. market.
In the U.S. market. And so, you know, I hope that what he's doing is taking the long view, and if he does that, and if General Motors can afford to let him take the long view, if he's selling fewer cars at a higher profit, at a much higher profit, then in the long term it might be worthwhile.
And I think you also have to look at some of the leadership at Cadillac until Denison came in. You know, I mean, I don't think that was their that was their strong point, was competing in the luxury market, which is the toughest and the incredibly tough. I just find it ironic that I think Cadillac now has the best products it's ever had, or certainly in the past 30 years. The ATS is just tremendous. Dynamically, it may be they're not quite there with the engines, but dynamically it's better than a 3 Series. I love driving both the ATS and the CTS. They're terrific cars. They should be doing better than they are. I think some of it goes back to leadership at the top. I think they've got a good guy in there now. But look at how long it took for anybody. Acura still isn't there in the luxury market. I mean, look at how tough the luxury market is. It's not someplace that you can turn around in a year or two, you know.
Okay, so I'm the king of the world, and Todd, I'll start with you. You're Johan Dennison now, and you've just been given Cadillac, and you've got all this experience at Infiniti and Audi. What do you do with it?
Wow. Didn't you hear what Dave said? There are no more kings, there are only coaches. So you should be coaching me. And what you should be coaching me to do is, yes, they need more product. They need to stick with this rear-wheel drive direction. I think that's the way to go. And I think, again, it's a very much a long-term process. It takes two or three generations of a good model to help to restore, to give that model a good reputation. And you need several of those models for the general public, the luxury buying public, to say, you know, yes, Cadillac is finally the Cadillac of cars again. That's a really tough thing to do. I think as long as they keep working hard on the product, if Dennison pushes them to work hard on the product, improve the interiors, improve the drivetrains, fill in some niches where they're not now, but don't go overboard the way BMW and Mercedes have and try to fill every niche. Let even Buick take the lower end let them do the Mercedes CLA competitor instead of Cadillac. I think that's probably the best possible strategy.
Okay, Drew, you're in charge of Cadillac now. What do? You throw $5,000 on the hood and blow them out the door?
No, I figure out a way to get people in the dealerships to drive them, first of all. And I think you do more comparative test drives. And I think it has to be a lot of it more on the retailer level, where you get people in there to just so they can experience the car. And see how good it is, how well it drives, particularly against the best in the world. I mean, I think that's a key thing they have to do.
Drew, that's a great point about the dealerships. I suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect they still have too many white belt and shoes dealerships who want to put an aftermarket vinyl top on your new Cadillac. And I think maybe they don't have the kind of dealership experience that you would get at a Mercedes or BMW dealership, and that's part of what.
But how did Audi do it, or what did Johan Dennison do at Audi? Because Audi dealers did not have a good reputation in the United States, and the cars really—they were beautiful, they were nice, but they were not reliable either. So, how did they overcome this bad dealer, non-reliability image?
But it was product, and really, I mean, when you say they weren't doing, they had a bad reputation. They had no reputation. They almost pulled out of the market around 1992. Their sales were just north of zero, which is why, even today, every month they can say, "Well, we've had a record July, August, September." You know, it's true.
Because the prior ones were so bad.
They're heading in the right direction. But that's not to take away from what he did. He brought in products like the Q5 that Audi thought was not right for the U.S. market, and made that one of Audi's best sellers. They took the original Audi A4, what was called the B5 or something like that, and they made that car not unlike the Mustang or the Camaro, the car you buy when you're tired of your third Toyota Camry and you know it's going to go for another 500,000 miles, but you're just going to be bored to tears driving it. So you'd buy an Audi A4, and yeah, maybe some people found that they weren't going to go 500,000 miles in their Audi A4, but it was a nice step up from there, and they moved on with that. Now, Cadillac can't do that. They can't have entry luxury to grab Chevy or Toyota buyers. They need to be grabbing, in the old days, called Buick buyers. I'd say even Audi buyers, because Audi is still, in my mind, not quite the luxury car that BMW or Mercedes is.
Well, Audi also had a lot of leasing, has had some leasing deals, and Cadillac has not had the flexibility since the bankruptcy, to offer the kind of leasing deals, which, again, doesn't put you in that sort of, throw the cash on the hood type situation, but it does allow you to put people in a lot more car maybe than what they're looking at a competitor. And they need more flexibility. I think hopefully he'll be able to get that and lobby for that with.
But you got to do something right now, right? I mean, sales are a disaster. They're actually sinking a little bit. The ATS and the CTS are down double digits. Mm-hmm. You got to do something right now. And I know what you're saying, and I totally agree, Todd, that, hey, this is a 20-year plan, right?
Right.
But you got to do something right now.
That's a tough question because I think also of Lincoln, and you think that no matter how badly Cadillac is doing, they're not Lincoln, you know? I mean, they're selling some cars. And unfortunately, they're probably selling, I don't recall what the recent numbers are, but something like the XTS, which I think is not a good Cadillac going forward, that was a stopgap car. They need a new SRX pretty soon, and they need, frankly, in the luxury market now, they need more crossovers. Who knew? But, I mean, that's what Mercedes and BMW and Audi are doing.
I got to believe that Johan's got to be thinking about, hey, you know, we got to go big here. You know, maybe you make 4G LTE free for your lease.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you say, okay, you know, all the stuff that was optional, it's now standard. Yeah. You know, maybe you do, you never pay for maintenance, you know. I think they've got to do something that people go, oh, really? What's Cadillac doing? Maybe I got to go take a look. To your point, Drew, get them in the, get butts in seats at that.
24-month free maintenance would be a great idea for them because then they would be doing what the Germans are doing. The other thing is that I got to tell you, and I'm sure they'll defend this until they finally change it, the Q sucks. I mean, it really is bad. I still believe in dials for your radio and your HVAC. I think it's much safer.
You're talking about the interface.
But the interface of Q is a real disappointment, and they're holding steady with it in the same way Ford did with Sync and with my Ford Touch.
But Ford's backing off real fast now.
Well, they are now. Now that they've,
the Mustang, it's all buttons and knobs.
Now that they've had time to fix it.
Right.
And that's the problem is, just like you can't do an engine in 23 months anymore, you really can't even change something like Q in 23 months anymore. But they need a crash program to change that. I think that would make a big difference, frankly.
I got to believe they're working on that because I'm sure their feedback has not been positive on
it. I'm sure they are, and I'm sure they're going to deny they need to do anything with it
until they come out with a new one.
Yes. Right. Now the question is how soon.
Right. So what else? What else has caught your guys' attention this week?
Well, I think we just saw one of the biggest supplier mergers in a long time with ZF buying TRW, and I know I looked at that one and I thought, what? You got a transmission supplier buying an airbag supplier, or whatever. I mean, it just sounded kind of crazy. This big. I was happy to just see a little activity going on in the supplier space. But, you know, after I was just at a meeting last night with they had the CEOs there explaining the strategy and everything. And my takeaway was just the world is changing, vehicles are changing, and everything's connected to the internet or going to be, everything's interconnected. And really, and all the perceptions I had of what TRW is. It isn't really just an airbag supplier.
It's an electronics company.
It's an electronics company, and they also are in steering, steering and everything else, which they have in common with the ZF. But really, you see the future there. It's there's a lot of what they're thinking, autonomous cars or not even autonomous. And again, I think this is a great marketing effort by whoever started this idea of autonomous cars because really what they're talking about are better smart cruise controls and lane departure warnings and then combining
things we already have just connected together and made legal somehow.
And taking over maybe 80% of the driver's task. Well, that's not too hard to do, and that's where the future is. And, boy, there's a lot of electronics. That's a lot of stuff that people...
No, I think you nailed it on the head. I think that's exactly why ZF bought TRW. They said, wow, we're a great mechanical company. We need electronics. We need to be able to actuate the steering, the suspension, and all this for this semi-autonomous stuff right now leading to full autonomy.
Well, and to Drew's point, John and I, you and I have had some experience with the Continental autonomous systems. We've driven some of those and seen some of their systems. And Continental has changed a lot in the last 6 or 7 years. Haven't they bought up companies? They've had some sort of reorganization, and I haven't followed it, I'm sure, the way you have. But is this maybe a little bit of, hey, we've got to keep up with Continental?
Well, I mean, I think it's keeping up with the shareholders, I think, a lot. Now, ZF is a privately held company.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, any business, they want to see greater margins. They need to see stronger profits. And when you're machining things and doing bending metal and stuff, that often doesn't return the kind of margins that shareholders or anybody else wants to see. The electronics, there's a lot more, you know, voodoo inside that you can charge for.
Not only that, but, you know, ZF is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily a transmission company, right? Well, as electrics come on the scene, guess what? They don't need transmissions. Fuel cells are right around the corner. They're not going to need transmissions. That's where you got to think the guys at ZF are going, hold the horses.
Yeah.
We better hedge our bets here.
Yeah.
And so now they will be the second largest tier two. Is that correct?
Tier one.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I was thinking two is too much. Second largest tier one. And I'm guessing it's probably a little bit the inverse of what the auto business, what the OEMs are, and that is the bigger you are, the better leverage you have with your tier one suppliers. Well, if you're a bigger tier one supplier, you probably have a little more leverage.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a great point. Think about it. You know, from a revenue standpoint, Bosch and now the TRW ZF, revenue-wise, they're bigger than companies like Subaru.
Yeah.
I'd have to look it up. I'll bet you they're about the same size of a Mazda.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a lot. Wall Street just talked a lot about that. I'm not sure if that really works in the real world when you're negotiating, but it's certainly something out there. It helps drive your stock price. And also, when you were talking about the biggest suppliers, yeah, everybody, Continental and Bosch, you know, they're all heavy into the same.
Listen to the names we're saying, because if we went back 15 years ago, we would be seeing companies like Delphi and Visteon as the biggest. Now they're all German.
Yeah. And if you go back 40 years ago, they were the Delco part of General Motors, and what Ford had Autolite and so on. So, yeah, exactly.
But one of the nicest things from this meeting last night that we were there when they were talking, like, nobody was talking about synergies and cost reductions anything like that. And they were saying, no, we're hiring. As a matter of fact, we're having trouble hiring, finding people, and we need to hire more, and we're growing. And TRW is based right here in Michigan in Livonia. Mm-hmm. That was just kind of nice. It was not a part of the discussion at all. We had to drive it out, pull it out of them, and they were like, no, we're not looking at
that. So what do you think is going to happen in the supplier industry? Is this more consolidation, fewer but bigger suppliers?
I think we're headed in this direction. You know, the other thing is, though, you see also like the seating in the interior companies. I mean, back in the 90s, that was consolidating like crazy, and everybody was saying, okay, we're a seat maker. We need to buy people that make carpets and interior parts. And then we'll sell the automakers
a full interior.
It's going to be great, you know. And then we'll have leverage, you know. And then guess what happened to that? The automakers didn't bite. They've been and now they've been pulling it apart. Now you don't. Lear and Johnson Controls have sold off most of their interiors businesses now.
Well, I think so, part of what undid that is the car companies started to realize, hey, we're losing the institutional knowledge of what it takes to design an interior.
Yeah.
And you know, and when our buyers go and talk with these suppliers, they get snowed. Why? Because our buyers don't even know what they're talking about, our engineers. So I think the pendulum went too far, and now they've realized we, the car companies, better know everything about our cars. We better have that institutional knowledge, because otherwise these suppliers have got us over a barrel.
That's I think a big part of it. And when you're designing cars, you want to have, you know, at the last minute, you want to really look at it as a whole, you know, as a whole interior, and have more control. And you don't want to be dealing with middlemen and everything else.
Well, it's also disturbing what you said about they're having trouble finding new engineers to hire. And it gets back to what Dr. Cole said about lack of people with the young people with the skills.
With the skills or even
with
the
education.
Well, you know,
and the interest.
I was happy.
Well, that's where it starts with the interest.
That's right. Why I was happy. One other development in the supply community. We, Continental, just they poached a top executive from Google a couple months ago. So that's kind of cool. She's and now.
And that's a good sign. And, and the reason I say that is when the tech. The Silicon Valley tech people go, hey, I want to go work for a car company.
Yeah.
Maybe the pendulum's starting to swing in that regard.
And I talked to her a little bit about it because I was trying to figure out why, why would somebody from Silicon Valley, and she built up this huge career, why on earth would you want to even deal with Detroit? You know, I mean, the way they think of greasy stuff in Detroit. She sees an ability to really make some big changes. You know, she looks at the auto industry as something that's just poised here to make some enormous changes that she can influence, and she's going to, really be able to make her mark. So that's cool.
That'll be interesting.
Some good stuff happened this week.
Cool. Hey, I want to thank you guys for coming in. Todd, awesome having you here. Drew,
thanks, John.
Same thing. I thought it was cool getting the inside story of how the small block Chevy came about. That was pretty good. Good stuff.
Plug next week's show.
With?
From Colorado, Canada.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Chip is telling me next week the show is going to be on the road. We're heading out to San Diego, California. We're going to be talking with the Chevrolet people all about the new Colorado, this smaller pickup that they're coming out with. So don't miss that show either. But in the meantime, thank you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.